We're going to have a long history here in Ann Arbor. Would you welcome John Sinclair?
I'd like to introduce my guitarist, George Friend. The last time I had the honor and privilege of opening for one of my mentors in poetry, Michael McClure, and Ray Manzarek, last year, we did a program of works written after Columbia Smart compositions. Tonight, George and I would like to do an evening of blues poetry, and we want to call on Mr. John Lee Hooker for the invocation. This is a little statement by John Lee that I cast into verse under the title The Healer. The Healer, that's the record that he got the Grammy for when he was 72 years old last year. Poetry, some are pretty heavy, so heavy I can hardly carry them. But sometimes on stage, when I'm singing them, it gets so sad and deep and beautiful, I have to wear dark glasses to keep the people from seeing me crying. I'm kidding. The tears just start running with the words that I'm saying and the way that I sing. But sometimes I give my own self the blues. John Lee Hooker is here. And we're going to do a suite of works in verse from a project called Fattening Frogs for Snakes. Subtitle The Delta Sound Suite. And it deals with the geographic region of the Mississippi Delta and also the artists who created the music that came out of there. The cradle of American civilization as we know it. The first piece is called The Delta Sound. Says there ain't too many left that play the real deep blues. Ain't too many more left. There ain't too many left sing the type of blues that I sing. Muddy Waters to Robert Palmer in Deep Blues. Of the Peabody Hotel in Memphis, where the Delta begins, down Highway 61 through Tunica and into Clarksdale, Mississippi. This is where the music was born and bred in miles and miles of cotton field. One room sheds, dirt roads stretching across the countryside. Standing at the crossroads where 49 meets 61, we're waiting in the dark for the train to make it down the track and jump on board, because anywhere else is better than this place. This is where the music came to be. Boogie Lightning against the sky. Tommy Johnson and Charlie Patton making their pacts with the devil at the stroke of midnight. Rekha at the crossroads of Africa and America. Black men and women dragged in chains and shipped in chains and whipped in the Mississippi, where the music came to life under the whip and the gun, and hours of relentless sun beating down every day on the slave temples, cutting trees, pulling stumps like mules, plowing the cleared land, panting, picking cotton, dawn to dark, the music deep inside them, coming out in grunts and groans, and the moans of the spirit of the ancestors, in the train whistles, in the air, everywhere, the land soaked with their blood, the night alive with the spirit voices raging over their crops, the fruits of their labors, the richness of the land, a constant mockery. Everything they made was taken away. Everything was stolen from them. But the music made life go on and moaned people to stay alive and led them out of the Delta to Chicago or Detroit, but some big city, some other place where no cotton grows, and the crackers wear suits or carry lunch pails, and the plants pay that good money, and the music gets harder and louder, lightning, electricity leaping from the wall. The Delta sky brought to bear on the city, deeper than deep, from where all things rise. The Delta sound, ain't too many left, ain't too many more left, ain't too many left at all.
This is a piece that's written after a song popularized by Robert Johnson in 1937 called Crossroad Blues. And if you don't know that, put all of Robert Johnson's existing works out on CD last year. And he went gold. So if Robert were merely around, he reaped the reward.
This is called Crossroad Blues. It's dedicated to my friend Gary Duncan.
Crossroads.
Mississippi in 1896, left home around 1912 with an older woman and traveled north to Rolling Fork, then settled farther north in Boyle near the Dockery Farm by 1913, right on the line of the P-Line Special, where he spent a year or two studying with Charlie Patton, Willie Brown, Dick Bankston, Ben Marie and them at Dockery's, and then returned south to Crystal Springs and his family and the people who used to know him. By this time, Tommy Johnson had developed a style of his own, not just in his music, but as a compulsive womanizer, an acute alcoholic who would drink almost anything, Sterno, shoe polish, the works. His brother Liddell asked him how he had learned to play so well in such a short time. He said the reason he knowed so much, said he sold himself to the devil. I asked him how, and Tommy Johnson said, if you want to learn how to play anything you want to play and learn how to make songs yourself, you take your guitar and you go to where a road crosses that way, where a crossroads is. Get there, be sure to get there just a little before 12 o'clock that night, so you know you'll be there. You have your guitar and be playing a piece, sitting there by yourself. You have to go by yourself and be sitting there playing a piece. A big black man will walk up there and take your guitar and he'll tune it. And then he'll play a piece and hand it back to you. That's the way I learned how to play anything I want. And Bob Palmer adds, the black man referred to is recognizable as Legba, a Yoruba trickster god who opens the path for other supernatural powers and is traditionally associated with Crossroads. As the only wholly unpredictable deity in the Yoruba pantheon, the rituals that are virtually guaranteed to bring a desired response from all others do not necessarily work in his case. Legba became identified with the devil of Christianity early on. Early on. I'd like to do a little train song, a little Delta train, and it's just pieces written after a song recorded by Charlie Patton, and it's called P-Vine Special, P-Vine Special, P-Vine, and it's dedicated to two friends of mine, Rick Steiger and Rick Spangler, P-Vine. I use the music from Junior Parker's composition, Mystery Train. Special hooked up to after the daiquiri farm where the Delta Blues came to flower just before the First World War. Peabody starts out from Cleveland, Mississippi at 4 a.m., runs 2 miles south to Boyle by Tommy Johnson's place in 1914, then over to the private depot at Will Dockery's plantation, left over to Rosedale, and back to Cleveland before nightfall. And when it's darkness on the Delta, you can hear that train coming from a long way on, and it's so easy to ride. I take the Illinois Central to New Orleans, straight through to Chicago in 24 hours. Runway fare in 1940 is still just $16.95. But if you catch it in Memphis at the top of the Delta, runway to Chicago for $11.10. But see, you don't want to go that far. Catch the Yazoo and Mississippi Valley Railroad and ride the Yellow Dog up from Moorhead, where the Southern crossed the Dog, all the way to Tutwiler, where Highway 49 goes east and west, and where one night in 1903, sitting in the station, waiting for a train that was already 9 hours behind time, trying to get to a gig, the great W.C. Handy, father of the blues, first heard a Delta man play his guitar strings and sing his little railroad song. Down by the station, catch that train and ride. Why stay in this God-forsaken place when it's so easy to slide?
Peabody. We're going to essay an account in verse of the untimely demise of Robert Johnson, and it's written under the title of Hellhound on My Trail. And it's dedicated to my daughter Celia. Hellhound on My Trail.
And south out of Itabena on Highway 7, just a few miles to a little junction where a general store was called Three Forks, Mississippi. A gentleman out there ran a juke joint out of his house in 1938, out there in the country, down the Fork Road from the general store, which is closed down now, but it thrived 50 years ago. As much as anything could thrive in Mississippi in 1938, down the road, maybe right there by Highway 7, or maybe it was 3 or 4 miles down the Fork Road to where there's a little settlement down there by the riverbank, where they're building a new bridge now, down at the end of the Fork Road, where 6 or 7 little houses be at, right next to the river. Somewhere in there on the Fork Road, close to Three Forks, this man called Ralph ran a juke joint in his house every Saturday night. And people came out there in the country from all around there to have their fun, buy some liquor, dance, gamble some, rub up against each other for sex or violence, maybe cut up somebody out in the country Saturday night. And the man would have a guitar player and maybe a harmonica, maybe 2 guitars, musicianers from Greenwood, or maybe just passing through, like Robert Johnson in the summer of 1938. Every Saturday night, out by Three Forks, Robert would play at the man's juke joint in the country, and people would line up to get in, because Robert was getting very well known, and his records were coming out. All that year, 78 RPM Vocalions, cut in San Antonio and Dallas, Texas, starting in November 1936. Terraplane Blues, 3220 Blues, I believe I'll Dust My Broom, Walking Blues, Come On In My Kitchen, Stones In My Pathway, Love In Vain, Hellhound On My Trail. These were the records people heard all through Mississippi, and Robert Johnson was a man to be reckoned with in the blues world of the Delta, where he had spent all his life. And the ladies would crowd around him to press their favors upon him. The men would enjoy the music and the women dancing, and the excitement rising up in the women, pressing up into them on the floor, in the juke joint on the Fork Road. People crowded around, inside the joint and outside. Everything was nice and smooth there. Out by Three Forks, the man was selling his whiskey and making his money, and Robert was getting paid real nice. And then the man's wife, see, she got up next to Robert, and she threw her love on him so strong with some of that real good trim. And she went so far with her infatuation as to take off from her husband out there in the country and go on into Greenwood to lay up with Robert 1 or 2 days in his room, like a Monday and a Tuesday, say, before she go back to Three Forks and her husband with some cock and bull story about what she was doing over in Greenwood, her cousin or something, some kind of lame bullshit excuse, which her husband knew was not right, but he kept his mouth shut. And when Robert come back out to the juke joint the next Saturday night with his mind stuck dead on that sweet pussy and the concurrent joy of a Mississippi Saturday night, people having their fun in the woods, whiskey flowing, fish sandwiches, money changing hands under the coal oil lanterns in the dark, the girl's husband slipped Robert his usual bottle of spirits to get the night started, but only this time he put some shit in the game and dropped in a few shots of poison to fix this cocky motherfucker who thought he could take the man's wife and use her as he pleased, put his shag ass to fire and shit, his little bullshit records out, and that bitch on his dick, the man's wife. The man burned up inside every time he saw the pictures in his mind.
that bitch be pleasing Robert and probably be giving the motherfucker the man's hard-earned money too, and the pussy. He would fix Robert Johnson's ass, and he would call himself doing a favor to a legion of endangered husbands whose ladies were lined up by the stand trying to mash some stuff on Robert. The dirty, rotten motherfucker, he had to go. His time was come, and if he wasn't but only 27 years old, it was still time to go, said the man with the poison. And he put it in with the whiskey and had the bottle given to Robert, and Robert drank from it, took a few swallows to start the night off right, and while Robert played his first set, the poison was eating away at him, and death was inside of him. Before he knew it, he was coughing and gagging and shivering. On a hot night, he fell to the ground outside the juke joint and couldn't go back on the stand. He couldn't stand up. He could see that hellhound that he had that song about. Hellhound on my trail, about to keep moving. But he couldn't move his hand or get up off the ground. Robert Johnson, he couldn't get up to move. He laid there on the ground, poison eating away his life, staring up into the drooling jaws of the dreadful hellhound standing dead up over him, blood dripping from its eyes, its foul breath in his face. Robert Johnson, on his way to the spirit world, catch that greyhound bus and on.
Cases on their back, in their pants pockets,
toes, strapped to their chest like bolsters, rolled up like a wad of bills, chewed like dice, sharp and deadly as razors, stuck in the top of their socks, a 38 tucked in their waistband. Bruise in the cut of their bennies, bruise in the throat and chest, bruise from Mississippi, walked off the plantations and caught a train, or drove up Highway 61 in a beat-up Ford, or something a little slicker, a 1937 Hudson, or a 1936 Packard convertible with a big radio, picking up Count Basie at a KC, or the crowd clouds of joy, or Duke Ellington in a broadcast out of New York City, the blues in an automobile with holes hanging out the windows, or sitting back on a train from Memphis to Chicago, the blues in a nasty cardboard suitcase and a pocket full of harmonicas, all the way from Mississippi, blues came to Chicago screaming and kicking and grinning out of Mississippi where it came from, and it came to Chicago where it became the Chicago blues.
Chicago bound. Okay. We've got a funeral piece, a dirge, we'd like to do at this time. It's dedicated to a friend of mine who's no longer with us, John Hall. He appears in this poem. And I always like to remember I had the honor and privilege of reading this at his funeral. It's a funeral piece for Sonny Boy Williamson, also known as Rice Miller, and it's called Decoration Day. Cemetery just outside of Tutwiler, Mississippi, on or around Decoration Day, 1965. He died in his sleep on May 25th of natural causes, meaning his life ran out before someone with a knife or a gun or some poison could cause him to leave here before his time. He lived his life to the full, brooking no interference, asking no quarter, and certainly giving none. Robert Jr. Lockwood, his sidekick from the 30s and through the years, called him a terrible scout, which should give you some idea of what his enemies thought of him. But Rice never cared about his enemies or his friends, for that matter. He did exactly what he wanted to do and let the devil take the hindmost. He lived fast for an awful long time, and when he saw his time coming, he went back home to Helena to die, where he got his start, playing his harp and singing on KFMA radio. His friends were there, and his sister, and what family he had, and when he passed, they carried him across the river to Tutwiler and buried him next to the church. 12 years later,
In 1977, Miss Lillian McMurray of the Diamond Recording Company of Jackson, Mississippi, who cut his first records for her trumpet label in 1951, reached into her coffers and brought him a gravestone and had it erected in the weeds and bramble bushes next to the river behind the Whitfield Baptist Church just outside of town. 12 years he went unnoticed and unmarked, a giant in the earth, anonymously haunting the town where W.C. Handy first heard the blues in 1903. Oh, Sonny Boy, Sonny Boy, I'm down on my knees by your grave in the dark of night, February 1984, throwing aside the thorns and the long grass and weeds in the light of the headlamps of my car with John Hall beside me, geeked up pilgrims from the north on our way to New Orleans. Stopping by to say goodbye, baby, just one more time.
Thank you. Declaration, Greg. Coming up. Okay, this is a title piece from this little collection that NL League were published a couple of years ago at Ridgeway Press. NL will be here later this evening. He's my publisher. That's why it's out of print. This thing is taken from a statement by a guy named Frank Frost, who's featured in the second half of this poem. The first part is kind of a dubbed version of a statement by Willie Gibson. And it's all under the title, We Just Changed the Beat. And it's dedicated to two musicians who frequently accompany me, Johnny Evans and Martin Gross. We Just Changed the Beat. You know, Willie Dixon says, when you go to changing beats and music, you change the whole style. The difference in blues or rock and roll or jazz is the beat. The beat actually changes the whole entire style. The beat actually changes the whole entire style. Where you put that beat, be careful, or you'll change the whole, change the whole, change the whole entire. When you go to change your beat, you know, you can change, you can go to change him, you can change the whole style. Now Frank Frost of Lula, Mississippi, puts it like this. He says, I take them and rearrange them and it be a new recording to them. In other words, we taking the down blues and bring it up tempo. I don't know what you would call it. Just take the cotton picking blues, I would say, and bring it up to modern music today. I guess that'd still be blues. The only difference between the cotton picking blues and what we're doing today is the tempo. We're using practically the same word. Maybe one word in the whole thing could be changed. Let me see if I can give you something to remind you of back in those days. Any places you know.
Now that's getting me old, ordinary, original way, you know. That's just the cat picking blues that way. Then we change up just the tempo and the beat. That's the dance tempo you hear now. Just something they can dance to these days. That's the same blues. We just change the beat. It's no hypnotic.
Finish with a couple of Muddy Waters pieces. His first piece is was first recorded by Muddy Waters down in Stubblefield, Mississippi by the Library of Congress. And then in 1948 he made a commercial version of it in Chicago for the Chess Brothers. That was his first hit. It was called I Can't Be Satisfied. And it's dedicated to two friends of mine now, Ann Arbor residents, Ken and Ann Nikolowski, two great Americans. I can't be satisfied. Early in 1948, for aristocrats, I can't be satisfied. That's when I feel like going home. Released in April 1948, the initial pressing sold out all over Chicago. Just over 12 hours later, Teddy says, I had a hot blues out, man. I'd be driving my truck, and wherever I'd see a neon beer sign, I'd stop, go in, look at the jukebox, and see my record on there. I might buy me a beer and play the record, and then leave. Don't tell nobody nothing. Before long, every blues joint there was, that record was on the jukebox. And if you come in and sit there for a little while, if anybody was in there, they're gonna punch it. Pretty soon I'd hear it walking along the street. I'd hear it driving along the street. About June or July, that record was getting really hot. I would be driving home from playing 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and I had a convertible with the top back, because it was warm. I could hear people all upstairs playing that record. It would be rolling up there, man. I heard it all over. One time, I heard it coming from way upstairs somewhere. And it scared me. I thought I had died. Okay, we're going to close with another Muddy Waters piece.
And it's appropriately titled Louisiana Blues.
For my friend Frank and Peggy Bob. Louisiana Blues. Thank you.
McKinley Morgan Field in Rolling Fork, Mississippi, April 4, 1915. Down on Highway 61, about halfway between Vicksburg and Greenville, taken north some 100 miles to Tullahoma County by his maternal grandmother at the age of 3, and raised there on the stubble plantation between Clarksdale and Friars Point, where he gained a new name from all the time playing in the mud and eating it. Muddy Waters, genius of the blues, master of verse, voice, and guitar, an interpreter of songs, like this one by the bard of Vicksburg, Willie Dixon. I got a black cat bone, I got a mojo tooth, I got the John the Conqueror, I'm gonna mess with you. This is my water speaking. Con job on people's heads, you know, getting the fools. And these mojo doctors was driving big cars on big homes because the peoples was brainwashed. My grandmother and father, their mother and father, was so brainwashed they thought people could point their finger at you and make snakes and frogs jump out of you or make you bark like a dog. They said if they get some of your hair from a certain spot right on the top of your head and bury it or put it in running water, that could give you a headache. Now that could be possible. And I think down in Louisiana, they could have had a few friends that would do something. But if such a thing as a mojo had have been good, you'd have had to go down to Louisiana to find one. Where we were in the Delta, we could do nothing, I don't think. And there is no way I can shake my finger at you and make you bark like a dog or make snakes and frogs jump out of you. Bullshit! No way! But you know, when you're writing them songs that are coming from down that way, you can't leave out something about that mojo thing. Because this is what black people really believed in at that time. We played so many times. I'm going down to Louisiana, get me a mojo hand. And I tried to make a picture so you could see it, just like you're looking at it. When I was singing it, I didn't believe it. No way. But even today, when you play the old blues, like me, you can't get from around that. I get so many requests. I could play Going to Louisiana every night if I would do it. And on the record, Little Walter says about Going to Louisiana, I'll take me with you, man, when you go.
Thank you.
don't give us many encores in the poetry records. As a young man living in Helena with his mother around 1928 or 29, Robert Lockwood had the good fortune to meet his mentor, Robert Johnson, who had big eyes for Robert's mama and hung around the house there where Robert Jr. got his music and then his new name. Robert says, "At the time, my ambition was to play a piano or an organ. I had heard a lot of guitar players, but I wasn't interested in them. But then Robert came along, and he was backing himself up without anybody helping him and sounding good. He would go somewhere to play for people and tear up the house. So I got right on top of that. By him having a crush on my mother, I got a chance to be around him a little bit. I think I'm about the only one he ever taught. Robert was like a father to me, or a big brother, and he accepted me like a baby brother or a son. He was real open with me, and he had me playing inside of 6 months. In fact, I had learned 3 of his tunes inside of 2 weeks. I was already musically inclined. Robert wouldn't show me stuff but once or twice, but when he'd come back, I'd be playing it. Better than a year passed, and then he took me to Mississippi to play with him. In Clarksdale, Robert pushed me out from under a knife once. We were playing on the street, and later on I remember that everywhere, every street corner we had been on that day, this lady was there. I didn't notice her, wasn't paying her no attention, and all of a sudden, she came at me. Robert shoved me. If he hadn't, he would have cut me. Around 1934 or 35, Race Miller began to appear at Robert Lockwood's door, speaking getting his mother's permission, could Robert Jr. accompany him? Rice Miller, later known as Funny Boy Williamson, secret hero of these poems, the greatest harmonica player of all time. So Robert says, I started going to places in Arkansas with him, but he worried my mother for about 2 years before she let me go to Mississippi with him. And sure enough, we had some pretty strange experiences there. One time, we left the Delta and went up into the hill country. And in Stardust, they put us in jail for vagrancy for 21 days. That was on a Friday. On Saturday, we went up to the second floor and raised the jailhouse windows and started playing. In a matter of minutes, the jailhouse was surrounded with people. There was a little fence down there, about as big as the one on the side of my yard, and the people started throwing nickels and dimes and quarters and dollars over that fence. The trustee went out there and picked the money up, and we knew he didn't bring it all to us. We knew he got that. But when he turned it into us, we had made $400 that day. The next night, the high sheriff and the deputy sheriff came and asked us, did we want to go out to make some money? Sid and Ed was their names. And for the next 21 days, they took us out to serenade for the whites every night but Sunday. They take up the money for us, pass the hat, make the people not put nothing less than a dollar in it, and then they take us back and put us in jail. Now, mind you, there was busting places for corn whiskey left and right, and they gave us a whole gallon of that. We had girls coming to the jailhouse, spending the night. We would eat for a hotel down the street. So it really wasn't like being in no jailhouse. But it was terrible because it was against our will. See, this particular part of Mississippi was really starved for music. And the police officers, they left the way we found it and just took advantage of being police officers. They knew the only way they were going to be able to enjoy us was to lock us up. Funny Boy was doing quite a few country and western things. You Are My Sunshine and stuff like that. But we would do the blues for them too. Some white people down there always did like the blues. They just didn't like the people who created the blues. Well, by the time our 21 days was up, we had close to $1,000 apiece. So old man Ed asked me and Funny Boy at the same time, look, if I turn y'all loose, what y'all gonna do? And I mean, I'll tell you the truth, even if it hurt me. I grew up like that. I said, Mr. Ed, I'm getting the hell out of here.